This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's Emma Barnett here. Welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast.
Since losing his health secretary and chancellor within minutes of each other last night, and the resignations continuing this morning with a minister and parliamentary private secretary gone by 9 a.m, a former aide to the Prime Minister has described his current mentality as a scorched earth policy, in which you're retreating and you burn everything to the ground as you go. That insight was shared with the politics website Politico. The next appearance from the Prime Minister will be in 2 hours' time at noon for Prime Minister's Questions. Last night, the Conservative backbench MP, Roger Gale, whom it's safe to say is no fan of the Prime Minister, made a particular point I wanted to put to you today. He said Margaret Thatcher and Theresa May were honourable women and resigned, and that he would like to think Mr. Johnson is an honourable man and will do the same, going on to say, the game is up, this is an open door, walk through it, and if the Prime Minister won't do it, collectively the Conservative Party has to do it for him. What do you make of that theory? Honourable women leaders have resigned. I mean, of course, some men have resigned. David Cameron resigned too, albeit in a highly specific set of circumstances after losing the argument over the European Union and our membership of it. But what is your take on that theory? We've only had two female leaders, of course, and both did resign. But is it honourable to resign? Is that a word you would use? And this morning, where are you at with this? Do you think Boris Johnson should resign? Text me here at Woman's Hour on 84844. Text will be charged at your standard rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email me through the Woman's Hour website. Also on today's programme, music from soul singer P.P. Arnold, fresh from her Glastonbury set, age 75. Another row in the Labour Party over some women being refused a stand at the party's annual conference. And Gabby Logan and Farah Williams, an ex-Lioness, who's the most capped player for England out of the women and the men, will be getting you warmed up for the Women's Euros. Euros 2022, which kick off this evening. Highly anticipated, of course, due to that pandemic delay. But Boris Johnson is starting what could be seen as one of his toughest days yet as Prime Minister after two of his most senior ministers, Secretaries of State, dramatically quit last night. Health Secretary Sajid Javid went first, followed just minutes later by the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, who said the public expect government to be conducted properly, competently and seriously. Well, I await your views on this as part of the public. Next came a series of junior ministers and aides tendering their resignations, including Bir Mafalami, who stepped down as vice chair of the Conservative Party live on television. This morning, I mentioned, more before 9 a.m, the Children's Minister Will Quince, who went on the television and the radio, you may remember, on Monday, talking to my colleagues here on the Today programme to defend the Prime Minister earlier this week and what he had been told was the truth, a version of events. And Laura Trott, a ministerial aide in the Department for Transport, has also quit this morning. While two men moved up into the Chancellor's and Health Secretary's respective offices, one woman made up a move up within Number 10. Boris Johnson's now Chief of Staff in Number 10 is a woman, Samantha Cohen, worked for 18 years for the Royals. Well, joining me is someone who knows that role pretty well because she was the deputy to it. It may have all slightly changed in terms of what the role does, but that's Kate Fall, Conservative Baroness and former Deputy Chief of Staff for David Cameron. But before I come to Kate, Let's go first to Noah Hoffman, a political reporter at The Sun, who was the one who broke the story about the Conservative MP Chris Pincher, the former Deputy Chief Whip, his resignation last Thursday, which kicked off this latest political episode. Noah, quite a lot's happened since then. Good morning.
Morning, Emma. Yes, you could say that. We did expect the story to have some very serious ramifications due to the nature of the allegations, due to the seriousness, and also due to the fact that this was such an open secret within Westminster. Every man and woman and their dogs all knew that this man had some very, very serious concerns attached to his name. So we knew when this came out, questions would be raised about who knew what and why action wasn't taken further. So I think that this really was perhaps the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of wavering ministers who really weren't comfortable and just needed that one final reason to make the move away from backing Boris.
But the majority on the payroll in terms of ministers and those supporting them, those private secretaries, have stayed.
Yes, they have, although I wouldn't be shocked if some of them perhaps changed their minds because we've seen some big names this morning. Laura Trott is seen as a rising star within the Conservative Party. She's very, very competent, smart, good with media, very switched on. So her resignation could have big ramifications for those who are looking to maybe be the future stars of the Conservative Party. And then we also have names like Liz Truss and Ben Wallace, who have been touted as future leaders as well. They're very tied up with the war in Ukraine and understandably perhaps think that now wouldn't be the time to make any moves, though that's not me saying that they will in the future, but it wouldn't be a shock if when things calm down a bit, when they're perhaps less busy with Ukraine, with Russia, they might make a move too. And I think with every single resignation, it's a further wound into Boris Johnson. It's a further flame that he needs to put out, and it's further pressure on others to act, because who really wants to be the last man standing in this government? And what future would that person have?
He perhaps views his deal with the electorate, not with those he has hired to be around him. And that's perhaps what he's still counting on. How long do you give him as a woman in the know, Noah?
Oh, do you know what? These things are so dangerous because Westminster, anything can change at any minute. I don't think he will be leading the Tory party into the next general election. I think we'll watch what happens over the next week, particularly with the 1922 backbench committee. They've got elections to their executive coming up, and the executive is very powerful because they can determine when a no confidence vote in the prime minister is triggered.
And that may change some of the rules around that as well.
Yeah.
No, I imagine you're going to be someone we hear a lot more from and continue to talk to. I look forward to it. Noah Hoffman, a political reporter at The Sun. Let me bring in the former Deputy Chief of Staff for David Cameron, the Conservative peer, Kate Fall. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Do you want Boris Johnson to stay?
I think it's pretty impossible for him to stay now. Things are unravelling, and they have been for some time. There is a sense that he's just staying for himself. Why is he there? He's lost his authority. He's not going to be able to continue running the country. We have massive issues, not just a war, but cost of living crisis. And he's lost his authority to rule. There's no longer competency, and the party just don't support him
anymore. But never mind the party, if I may say. I know you're a member of it, you're a peer of it. The people might not want him to go. I mean, we don't know that. There is a poll out this morning from YouGov showing it is now against him, if you like, the majority. I'm looking down the text message console from our listeners. I haven't found one yet that says he should stay, but perhaps they aren't listening to Woman's Hour this morning.
Well, I mean, I think you make a good point. I mean, it was 3 years ago when he did win, not 3 years ago when he won an election, but 3 years ago when he became prime minister, and he did win a huge victory. And his sort of deal has always been over the heads of the MPs in many ways to the people of our country with a huge majority. But just look at those by-election results recently, not just the Red Wall seat crumbling, but the old coalition that was very much a sort of coalition of my time in office also looks like it's crumbling. And there is a sense that the country isn't supporting Boris anymore. They don't like the fact that they don't believe what he says. And so I think you'll find that that is sort of the final death knell for Boris, a sense that the country isn't behind him, the MPs are coming to get him.
I have just received the first message saying, I don't think Boris Johnson should resign. It's appalling that the rats seem to be leaving what they think is a sinking ship. This has been an unprecedented time for our government and indeed world governments. Smaller damaging stories are being published in order to weaken the Prime Minister. The silent majority are never listened to and are too busy working to be heard in today's world. No name at the end of that message, but I wanted to share it with you. I'll share with all of you some of the other messages too. But I wanted to get your response to the question I put to our listeners right at the start of the programme when I was quoting the backbench Conservative MP Roger Gale, who said, Margaret Thatcher and Theresa May were honourable women and resigned. Now, you obviously worked also for a prime minister, a man who resigned. But what do you make of that theory?
Well, I thought it was an interesting thing to say. And I do think it was interesting, both Theresa May and Margaret Thatcher resigned. You know, they had ballots from their party and they won, but not with sort of huge amount of votes. And they went on to rule for a bit and then it all came unstuck. But I think an interesting point that there is a sense of humility and dignity in a resignation, rather than waiting to you know, the bunker, the final day when we just can't go on for any longer. And I do think that message is an important one for Boris Johnson right now, because I take the view of what one of your listeners writing in, but I do think that, you know, Boris has shown himself to be a brilliant campaigner but not a good governor. He isn't a great decision maker. There's been incompetence. It's not a decent and a government of integrity, and I think people are just fed up.
Well, to your point about it being seen as honourable to resign, who's written in, says, should Boris Johnson resign? Yes, although I'd prefer the public humiliation of him being dragged off the dispatch box. Far more satisfying. I mentioned about a woman who's got a promotion in all of this, Samantha Cohen, not a household name, now Chief of Staff at Number 10. Her nickname apparently is Samantha the Panther. I'm not quite sure why. She used to work for the Royals. I don't know if you know her, but in terms of the work that's cut out for you, as you put it, are losing authority and trying to be Chief of Staff of such an operation, how does that work?
Well, I mean, congratulations on her job. I think it's interesting, isn't it, that having picked some MPs for those key roles in Number 10, then they quickly moved out of the building, which of course is not something you can do if your job is basically just connected to the PM. But look, Emma, they will just be firefighting today. They're, and I think this is one of the problems with Boris remaining in office, is huge issues, and yet they're firefighting. They're not actually able to spend a lot of time running the country, or in fact thinking about how to make things better for the people of the country. And I think that is the key bit of the problem.
Yes, because of we were told yesterday, it was reported, I think I read it across a couple of sites, that a big meeting was happening between him and his inner sanctum, the Chief of Staff, Chief of Communications, meant to be talking about cost of living, tax cuts, tax hikes as well, you know, all of that and how that fits together our lives. And instead, this issue, the whole issue, and what had been said and what hadn't been said was on the table instead. Just a final question to you, Kate. You are a Conservative peer. If you feel so strongly about Boris Johnson not being a good governor, not being the man who should remain the leader of the country, why are you still a Conservative peer? Why have you not resigned?
Well, I'm a Conservative peer, and it often happens in politics that, you know, some people when in my time in Number 10 didn't support our whole agenda and they remained in the party. And I haven't supported a lot of the Boris Johnson agenda, but that doesn't mean I'm not a Conservative. And I hope that maybe whoever takes over that job later, I will be supporting their policies more.
You're waiting to see. OK, we will see. Kate Fall, Conservative peer still, Baroness, former Deputy Chief of Staff for David Cameron, thank you. Let me give you a flavour of some of your messages before I talk to my next guest about something completely different, a whole other world. Should Johnson stay or should he go, says Jude. I hope he stays. We'll have nothing to laugh at if he goes, Sue, no, he shouldn't resign. That would make him look vaguely honourable, which he most certainly isn't. Much better for all decent Tories, and there are many, to force him out and leave him completely disgraced. That's how Sue puts it. Unfortunately, she says, to go on, he'll continue to pop up as a speaker. It'd be great if he sank into obscurity, never again invited as an after-dinner speaker. Can't see that happening, though, but at least he won't be able to do any more damage to the country. A rare message to add to the other. It may just be representative of who feels like texting this morning. If you've never texted a radio programme before, now's your chance. But a rare message here from somebody who is in favour of Boris Johnson. Again, they may not be listening those, or they may not feel so inclined. But if you would like to get in touch, I'd like to hear from you. Text me on 84844. I think Boris Johnson has done a great job with Brexit, COVID and Ukraine. Let him get on with it. What's the alternative? Labour, union-backed, they destroy the country, reads that message. Well, we're going to come to the Labour Party in another row, actually, in short order. Another one, Johnson should resign. His personality flaws are more apt for a second-hand car salesman than for the Prime Minister of a G7 country. And so it goes on. Please keep your messages coming in. Now, I did mention we'll move on to a new world, a different world, because who's just walked into the studio but the 75-year-old American soul singer Pat Ann Cole, best known as P.P. Arnold, who started out singing gospel at church by the age of 17. She was married with two children when a prayer led her to find fame as an Ikette with the Ike and Tina Turner Review. They came to London to support the Rolling Stones, and then she broke away to find solo work. And in a career spanning more than 50 years, she's worked with artists from Eric Clapton and The Small Faces to Barry Gibb, Paul Weller, Ocean Colour Scene and Primal Scream. And she's appeared in musicals too, including Starlight Express. And most recently, only days ago, she performed solo at this year's Glastonbury. Pat joins me live in the studio. Good morning. And I should say, you've written your story now and what a life it's been and continues to be in the autobiography Soul Survivor. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Lovely to have you here. What do you feel like when you hear the body of work like that?
It's great. You know, it's I love everything that I've done, actually. I've been really blessed to work with, you know, so many great artists and producers. And so, yeah, I just want to do some more.
Exactly. Well, I was going to say, you know, we could start at the beginning, but why don't we start with Glastonbury, actually? How was that?
It was great. It was great. I made it. I wasn't sure I was going to make it because I had had a bout with COVID.
Oh.
You know,
but okay?
I cleared. Yeah, I was fine. I cleared on the Thursday and I was performing on the Sunday. And yeah, so.
What was the atmosphere like? How
did
it feel?
It was brilliant. It was really nice. You know, I have such lovely, supportive fans and everybody enjoyed the show and I got some great reviews and good feedback.
No, it looked like people really enjoyed it. I mean, I mentioned, of course, how you began and where you began. And it's certainly been a journey since then. But I wonder, why did you feel you wanted to put the story, if you like, behind the songs in a book?
Well, I started writing the book years ago.
Did you?
I started writing the book in 1994. And I actually lost it.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I was making a copy from Time Machine to a portable disc, and I lost my book. So it's a good thing it was my life story.
Because you knew it as well.
Well, yeah, and I had notes and things like that. But when I rewrote it, you know, God works in mysterious ways, and I decided to rewrite it, and I did a lot of ancestry work. Because I thought, well, if people want to hear about the gospel music and the soul, I'm going to take it all the way back to the plantation. So I did a lot of ancestry work and all that history of, you know, slavery and those hymns and everything. And so, yeah, I think it worked out better in the end.
Yeah, well, there is a lot in there. And there's also, you know, your experience is unvarnished. You know, you're very honest about some of the more difficult, very difficult things that happened to you, as well as, of course, the wonderful things. I mean, I mentioned there you were young when you were chosen to be one of Ike and Tina's backing singers. That, I'm sure, just changed your life.
Well, it certainly did, because I had never had any ambition or any desire to be a professional singer. I was born into a family of gospel singers, so I grew up singing in church. That's just what I did. And I was trapped in a Unfortunately, I got pregnant when I was very young, and I was forced to get married, and I was trapped in a very abusive teen marriage. So I just said a prayer one Sunday morning, asking God to show me a way out of the hell that I was in. And an hour later, the phone rang, and then with my girlfriend, who wanted to be an ICAD, and another girl who was supposed to go with them didn't show, so they called me out of desperation and refused to take no for an answer, hung up the phone. They came, and I lied and told my husband I was going shopping. And an hour later, I'm in Tina Turner's living room singing, dancing in the street. So,
wow.
And, you know, Tina kind of put this bee in my bonnet, because after we did the audition, she goes, right, girls, you got the gig, right? And I'm going like, oh, no, not me. I'm just here to help. And so Tina said, I said, I'm in big trouble. If, you know, I should have been home 2 hours ago. I'm going to be in trouble. So Tina sort of said, well, if you're going to get in trouble for nothing, why don't you ride with us up to Fresno and at least see the show? Well, Fresno was 300 miles away. So I had left home at 12 o'clock that morning and didn't arrive back home until 6 o'clock that next Monday morning. And so my husband, sure enough, he was waiting for me. And, you know, because it was a very abusive marriage. And he hit me in the head, and it was as if he knocked some sense into me, because I suddenly remembered my prayer. And that morning, I didn't have a way out. And so this was, God had answered my prayer. So I became an ICAT. And, yeah, and it was the beginning. I was still married to him for a while after that. But, yeah, it was the beginning of my professional career.
And of course, we now know Tina Turner herself was going through a lot of pain and difficulty and abuse herself.
She really was, and that was very, very difficult for me to watch and experience that, because I was quite a damaged young girl myself, yeah. Very introverted and shy and everything, and having to watch her experience that abuse after she had like saved me from my situation. It wasn't nice.
Was there a sort of sisterhood in that, do you think?
Oh yeah, you know, Tina and the ICATs, we were all girls together, and we were the only girls on the road. Well, there was the tour manager and the woman who booked the gigs, you know. So, yes. Yeah, we were close, yeah. You know, makeup time, getting ready for the gigs.
And hugely talented. I mean, what you were creating together was magical, even if the backdrop of your personal lives at times were really difficult.
Exactly. And, you know, working with the Ike Tina Turner Review was an amazing experience musically.
I mean, I have to say, you know, this has been picked up from the book. You also chose to write about your own abuse at the hands of Ike Turner in the book.
Yeah, I did, you know, because Maya Angelou is the inspiration for me just writing my story at all. I just love Maya, you know, it was like, if I'm going to write it, which I didn't know how to write. I've never written anything before. I just sat down and started writing. So at a time, I didn't have anything going on. And I just decided to tell the truth. And I had never told anyone about that, except for my sister years later.
And specifically for people who haven't read the book, it's to talk about Ike raping you.
Yeah, yeah. And the details of it is in the book.
Yes.
You know, but I was a very young girl. I was still jail bait, really. You know, I was 17 when I joined that review, and I had two kids, I didn't tell anybody, because if I had told my parents, they would have like insisted that I come home, which meant going back to my abusive marriage situation. I didn't want to tell Tina. I didn't know how to tell Tina, because I didn't want her to think that I was after Ike or anything like that, because she was already dealing with that whole thing of Ike having loads of women and all of that. And so I just kept it to myself. I just decided that I didn't want to lose my job. because that job was my way out
yes.
of my marriage and the way forward to support my young kids.
Has it felt healing, putting it in the book and sharing it?
Well, yeah, the book was quite cathartic. And like now, I mean, I've never done any therapy or anything, so I'm doing my therapy in front of the whole world, you know. So, yeah, it's quite amazing, you know, like, and going through the editing processes and everything every time, you know, having to go over it and over it and over it. And it's really, you know, so emotional, especially doing the recording. The audio book was really emotional for me.
I mean, I was going to say it just brings another meaning to the title, Soul Survivor.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, I look back and wonder how I got over, really, sometimes, you know.
I mean,
it was a different time. Yeah. I'm not the same young, frightened, you know, introverted, scared young girl that I was then. So I can look at that. It's the past. Even though I'm actually talking about it now in the present, you know, it's just like, it's just the truth, you know, and the truth will set you free. And I never told my story. I know anybody who knows me, I know a lot of people in this industry, people don't know me in the way that they will, you know me through reading my book.
Well, you do go there. It's a very powerful account. Thank you very much for coming to talk to us. And you do know a lot of people. You work with so many people and you did break away and do your own thing and have been doing your own thing ever since. And you also have a special relationship with the UK, I understand. You know, really came here and lived your life for a long
I've
period.
I've lived the majority of my adult life. I grew up in the UK. My children grew up in the UK. And the UK is where everything has happened for me. All my music experiences, all my music, you know, it's just my second home. I live between Spain. I have a home in Spain as well, and here, and my children, my son, and my grandkids are all here. So many friends, you know, professionally and personally.
Yes, yeah. And Glastonbury was all ready for you. P.P. Arnold, Pat, thank you so much for talking to me, talking to all of us. The book is called Soul Survivor. All the best with it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Now, to get back to politics, but a slightly different story, although I will reflect your messages, which are coming in this morning about Prime Minister Boris Johnson, whether he should resign, whether it's honourable to do so, with a comment from one of his backbenchers saying it would be. Look at the examples of women. Look at what Theresa May did. Look at what Margaret Thatcher did. I will come to your views on that and whether he should or could or would resign very shortly. But a group of Labour Party MPs and members of the House of Lords are challenging the party's decision to turn down an application by a group called the Labour Women's Declaration to have a stall at this year's Labour Party conference in Liverpool, which happens in September. This group, known as LWD on their website, describe themselves as a movement to raise the profile of women's sex-based rights within the Labour Party and the wider socialist movement. The Labour Party has told both organisations that the decision to turn down its applications, was purely a commercial one, and the applications for stalls were just oversubscribed, and that they're welcome to apply again next year. For anyone who hasn't been to a party conference, numerous charities, organisations, companies and pressure groups set up a stall in the exhibition area of the conference venue, which allows them to highlight their message to anyone attending. And one of those challenging the decision over LWD, just to remind you what that refers to, Labour Women's Declaration, their application, is the Labour peer, Baroness Diane Hayter, who sponsored the group's application. She's the former chair of the Labour Party's ruling body, the NEC, and a former shadow leader of the House of Lords. And just before I come to you, Diane, I wanted to say we did invite members of the Labour Party on this morning. Instead of anyone coming on, we have this statement which says we receive hundreds of applications for conference stands every year, meaning it is always oversubscribed. Not everyone can be successful. Labour passed the law that protects women on the basis of their sex and trans people from discrimination. We stand by it. Let's get to what you think's going on, Diane Hayter, Baroness Diane Hayter. Good morning.
Good morning.
The application process then, was it all as standard as you understand it? Was there anything untoward about that?
Yes, I mean, there are still spaces available. They've been telling us that there's no small spaces available, but we know there are big places available. And I'm offering that we will take one of the larger stands. They'll get even more money from us. And my offer to the Labour Party is if there are no small stands available, which we would have preferred, we'll have a big stand and we know those are available. I'm afraid this is not the answer. I mean, there is to turn down a group of Labour supporting women from the conference when Labour has done so much for women's rights. You know, I've been campaigning as a feminist for 50 years, and nearly all the major advances we've had have been from the Labour Party.
So what
government?
Well,
and
if this
continues, and we must continue to be there.
What do you think's going on then? Because the Labour Party's line, as I've just read it, is this is a commercial decision. It sounds like you do not believe that is the case. So what do you think is the real reason?
I'm afraid that there are some people who do not want us to continue the sort of campaigning we've done for years, which is that there are certain areas that should be, you know, confined for women only. And this is particularly, and it's all in the Equality Act that was passed by the Labour government. For example, hospital wards, same-sex wards, sleeping arrangements, you know, changing rooms, women's refuges, hostels, prisons. Women should be able, as we've just heard from your last speaker, you know, women's solidarity is very important, but also women sharing problems. You know, you had two women on yesterday who'd bonded over the fact that they were both widows of young children. And that spark, that understanding of women is one that women should be able to share.
So hang on, if we could try and keep it focused for a moment. I understand what you're saying about the bigger picture of how you view women working together. But to be clear, you do not believe the reason that the Labour Party has supplied to us as a programme and to you and to this group.
I'm afraid not. We applied very early. We are, you know, a Labour women's declaration. There are still big stalls available and we're very happy to take one of those. I used to be chair of the party and we never would have turned down a group like us. I'm afraid there are some people who I think do not want a group campaigning for women-only spaces to be able even to meet delegates and do that in a very safe environment of the Labour Party.
Because, I mean, we did invite the NEC General Secretary, David Evans, to join us on the programme, but our bid wasn't successful. We also issued an invitation to the Labour Party Chair and the Shadow Equalities Minister, Annalise Dodds. Again, she's not available today. She's out of the country, we were told, on other business. I suppose, you know, it's hard to get these answers to these questions that you're proposing without representation from them. But within the statement, it's clear that there is an understanding what you will be saying, you think is the real reason for this, because we have this line saying Labour passed the law that protects women on the basis of their sex and trans people from discrimination. We stand by it. What do you make of that as included in the response?
Well, it's interesting that they dropped in trans, isn't it? Because this has got nothing. I mean, why have they suddenly dropped in trans? I support trans rights. I mean, I have campaigned for that for years. I've been involved all my life for family reasons with trans issues. So why in the Labour Party response did they suddenly drop the word trans in? When we're a Labour group, a Labour women's group, I mean, I think the hint is there. I think the fact they won't come on and debate this. And I should say to you, we have asked to talk to them in private. I have made approaches at the very senior level of the Labour Party that we will go and meet in, you know, in confidence and talk through what are their problems. I mean, as I say, the fact they've dropped in trans suggests to me that there are pressures on them that somehow us campaigning just for women's rights, for human rights for women. I mean, we're not very revolutionary, really. Somehow is at odds with trans rights. I do not accept that.
Are there any areas of what was planned for the stand or communication around it? I've got no idea, that would be at odds with or perceived to be at odds with trans rights?
Absolutely not. I mean, I know there are some trans activists who feel that people who identify as women that are were born men should, if they have been subject to domestic abuse, as they can be, should have access to women's refuges. Now, women who are escaping, we've just heard, from your previous speaker, people who are escaping from male violence want to be in a completely safe female environment. And so there are undoubtedly, not many, but some trans activists who feel that keeping anything just for people born with a female body, with, ovaries and wombs and all the stuff that we've got, is somehow against their rights.
You don't accept that, but I suppose what that's why trans has been included in the Labour Party statement, isn't it? Because that's the perception and that's the concern. So,
and very interestingly, they only told you that. They have never told us that. Now, I find that really interesting. It took till we were on Women's Hour for them to give that. They said it was a commercial decision. And they've suddenly said something to you that they've never said to us.
So what's the next move? What do you think you're going to be able to do? Well, are you able to get a meeting
If it is a commercial decision, my offer to them, and I assume someone's listening, is we'll take the big stand, we'll pay more money, and if that is the reason, then they need to be able to give us
a... Oh, you've just frozen on me there. Your connection, sadly to say, because I did have one more question, but you have just disappeared. Sorry, but we were getting an idea of what was the next move, and you have one more question. Perhaps we'll get an update from Baroness Diane Hayter, who is a Labour peer and was supporting the application of that particular group, the Labour's Women's Declaration, which of course we wanted to hear about here on Women's Hour, to have a stand at the party conference, the annual party conference. But as I mentioned, we did ask for representation from the Labour Party, but were unable to get it, but got that statement in lieu of it. And I should have said earlier, I meant to tell you, just in case you were wondering, we did invite the government on this morning, just coming back to our lead story, across the UK today about the future of the Prime Minister. We did invite members of the government on today, or for them to put somebody forward to talk to us. But again, we were rebuffed. No one was available. In case you're wondering why we're not hearing from any of those who have, the majority of whom still have stuck around the Prime Minister. Getting your thoughts, thank you very much for these, on whether the Prime Minister should resign, whether it's an honourable thing to do, after examples were given of the only two female leaders we've had of this country doing exactly that. More messages have come in now on both sides, and more saying that Boris Johnson should stay. Let me try and reflect a couple of those as well as the others. Norma says, no, Boris Johnson should not resign. All politicians should get back working for the country and stop their self-indulgence. Another one, I have no political allegiance. However, I am an English teacher and I'm currently teaching the idea of bias. I do not think you are representing Mr. Johnson correctly. He has made misjudgments, but also many successes. I think it's very important to represent both to avoid a biased opinion. Thank you. No name on that particular message. Just reflecting that whilst honourable previous women parliamentarians have resigned, current senior women cabinet ministers have not so far. Not sure this bodes well for future female leaders, says Pat on a slightly different point. How can we talk to our children, reads this message, about right and wrong, telling the truth and appropriate behaviour? Why is Johnson still Prime Minister? Who are these Conservatives who stand by time after time and turn a blind eye? Day after day, I still can't believe it's going on. I support Boris still, reads this message. I know his shortcomings, but there's a part of the Tory party who have never liked him and are determined to find a way to get rid of him. You could find detrimental stories about most politicians, and I'm fed up with the media dragging up these stories and wasting public time that needs to be spent on the real issues. Just to say, I don't know if you saw this individual who sent this message, the Prime Minister, just before those resignations or as they were happening, was actually on the BBC last night apologising for his misjudgment and how this story about Chris Pincher, the former Deputy Chief Whip, was handled, and saying he shouldn't have been promoted. So messages there on that. But I think Boris Johnson is the right Prime Minister for the time, and the country overall is better with him in charge than anyone else I can think of. I'm a floating voter, by the way. Now, since the war began in Ukraine, an issue that many of you are bringing up also in your messages about the context we are in, the times we are in, more than 1,000 women have volunteered to join the Women's Defence League in Estonia due to concerns over the future safety of their country. Estonia borders Russia, and the women, ranging from school teachers to architects, say that they've made the decision to join because of worries their country could be a potential target for Russia. Just to say, at present, there's no public intelligence to suggest Estonia, will be invaded by Russia, but the fear is real. Estonia was previously under Soviet control for over 45 years. Well, just before coming on air, I spoke to one of the women who has joined this defence group, Maria Ann Klandorf, who works primarily as a car mechanic. And I started by asking her what motivated her to join the defence group.
Basically, the war, as I think it's the motivation for most of the people that joined it. But for me, I had the wanting to joined the military when I was younger. But when I was 11, I was diagnosed with diabetes. And then I was told that I can't pass the medicals. So I just kind of forgot about that for many, many years. And the day that the war started, I just went online and started looking at different options for me to help. And how can I help? What can I do? And I found out that there's this voluntary women's defense organization, and they have no limitations to you. Basically, you have to fill out a really basic medical form. By today, I think it's been changed that if you have a driver's license, you can use that medical form to apply. And
so you did, and you joined.
Yeah, I did. I got my my GP fill it out with absolutely no problems. I gave it in with my application, and about a month and a half later, I had this email confirming that I was accepted.
And what sort of training have you received?
For now, I have done all the mandatory basic training that includes some lectures on the organization, some lectures about safety, about how to put out a fire and self-defense. We got this as a lecture and as well as the practical part. I have done the cooking. That's also mandatory. You have to know how to prepare food in the woods. I have.
So it's an all round preparation, but I suppose the big part of it is the fighting and being able to defend. I'm not saying it's the only part, but it's the part. I can hear that from what you're saying. But I suppose I wanted to get a sense of how prepared is this particular group for fighting to happen? How would you feel about putting that into practice?
Well, the basic training teaches you to do all kinds of different things so you can pick the right thing for you. There's also the medical part. There are some women that want to take on the first aid side of things. And then there's this military bit as well. And I'm currently going through a bit more in-depth training on this military skills.
Yes.
For me, this takes 6 months and 2 weekends per month. It is quite hard, but it is definitely more intense than the one that the basic training in the Women's Defence League gives.
But why is this so important to you? I know you wanted to join the military and didn't, but why do you feel you want to do this now and dedicate your time?
For me, I think I like this country, and I just want to keep it the way it is, and I want to be able to do something, not just sit on my hands and see if it goes to hell in a handbasket. So I'm trying to do something.
And I suppose for us in the UK, what I'm learning and trying to understand from you is that this fear is real of what will happen to Estonia.
We do have some interesting neighbours in the east.
Yes.
So the fear is it's real, but since us and the Latvians and the Lithuanians were all part of NATO, it gives some security. So I don't think that there's a threat to us in the next day or maybe in a week, maybe even in a year, but the threat is real. So I would just like to be prepared for that.
And what is it about the women who've come together, this particular group? You know, is it important that it's women who have found a way to try and prepare together? Because that's also very striking.
Well, Estonia is a tiny country. We have only 1.3 million people living here. So if you put all of our hopes on the men, that pretty much diminishes the chance that we have. But if we have women there as well, that means we have way more, well, let's say, firepower. And the women here, well, they all think the same way. We want to keep what we have here. A lot of those women that have joined know what it was like being under the Soviets, and they don't really like it. So we have fought hard. We have 2 Independence Days. We don't really want to have a third one. So yes, we're going to fight for that. And we want to be prepared. So all the women, just we're working towards having skills and knowledge for if the worst case happens. And
is it women of all ages, all backgrounds?
For the Women's Defense League, it's all women from the ages of 18, and there is no upper limit. So there have been, I think there is one person at least who's currently around 90.
Wow.
Yeah. But if I remember correctly, she's been in this organization for quite some time.
A long time, okay. And because in your main role, you work as a mechanic, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And what?
I've been doing this for 6 years. And before that, 2 years were internship and still learning. So basically, I've been around cars for about 8 years.
And what do your colleagues make of you joining this organization?
Well, when they heard, they were a tiny bit shocked, but they're pretty supportive of this.
Okay.
Which is nice.
Yes.
And as well as my family, everyone is really supportive. And I've dragged my mom to join the Defense League as well.
Really?
Yeah.
How old's your mom?
She's 64.
And she's ready?
She's there, but she doesn't want to take on the weapons part. She would prefer to just cook for everyone. She wants to be the biggest friend to every soldier.
Two incredible women, mother and daughter team there, Maria and Klandorf. Thank you to her for taking time to talk to us today. You've been talking to us all week about something that is finally here, well, nearly here, about the Euros, the women's Euros. You've sent in some amazing anecdotes of your involvement with football over the last few decades and how much it's changed. Finally, today is the day, the first day of those championships. England is the host. Tonight's first England game against Austria happening at Old Trafford is sold out. More than 500,000 tickets for all the matches have already been sold before a ball has even been kicked. All 31 games of the tournament will be shown live on the BBC. And not only do the Lionesses have an unbeaten run stretching back to September 2021, they've won all 3 friendly ties ahead of their Euro 2022 opener, and they join Germany, Sweden, France and Spain on the shortlist of favourites. Who better to speak to than Gabby Logan, one of the lead BBC presenters for the championship over the next 2.5 weeks, and by Farah Williams, an ex-Lioness who's the most capped player for England, and I just want to point out, of both the women and the men, and of course a BBC Women's Euros pundit. A warm welcome to you both. Gabby, how are you feeling today?
So excited, Emma. This is a delayed championship, obviously, because of COVID. So it feels like the build-up has been coming for so long. But actually, that delay, I think, works in England's favour. And it's, I think, the as you just mentioned there, those three warm-up matches could not have gone better. The build-up through Serena Wiegmann's reign has been fantastic. And it just feels like a really kind of like a perfect confluence of lots of brilliant things happening. The rise of the women's game in the last year in the WSL, and it's such a great style of football as well. So I can't wait till 7 o'clock tonight when we go on air on BBC One.
I'm looking forward to it too. I have to say, lots of people getting in touch, women and men, who have only very recently, as they put it, given it a chance, given the women's game a go. I know that sounds wrong to you, Gabby, but it's true.
Lots has happened over the last decade, the last 15 years. And Farah was part of the 2005 team when the championships were here then 17 years ago. And I'm sure Farah, in spite of her goals, will tell you that both the standard of the team in terms of its professionalism and also the way the tournament was received, it's night and day. You know, it doesn't detract from Farah's talents and brilliance as a player. But obviously, if you have a professional game where people are playing all the time in a professional league, the standard, the technicality is going to get better. The everything that goes around, the ephemera of the game in terms of the recovery and the rest and the S&C, everything is so much now kind of more akin to what we would expect from professional football. So I understand what people are saying when they say that, and they're not being rude or, you know, being kind of ignorant of the past. I think the game has just come so far in such a short period of time, really.
Farah, how are you feeling? Good morning. Welcome to the programme.
Morning. I'm excited. I didn't see much last night. I felt like a player again, but it was more the excitement that I'm going to be a pundit, you know, first time in a major tournament. So I kind of had those same feelings where, you know, as a player, I couldn't sleep because I was just overexcited. I kept, you know, turning to my phone and just looking to see if it was morning. So yeah, like a big kid again.
And
I'm really excited for the tournament.
Well, here we are, nearly, very nearly. And what's your reflection on what Gabby was just saying about the way the game has changed in terms of the style of it, but also the reception?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what Gabby was saying. And, you know, I was lucky enough to play in a home Euros in 2005. But as a team and as players, we knew we was never ready to really showcase our game then. It was obviously a great opportunity for us to play and, you know, a very proud moment for us to play in a home Euros. But the game has moved on drastically since those times. We're talking 17 years. And I really do believe wholeheartedly that the game is in, you know, a very good place. And a place where we can really showcase, you know, women's sport in general. I think, you know, as Gabby mentioned there, they're full-time professionals now. They get the correct S&C. They have the right diet and nutritionist, you know. And so going and they're used to playing in front of big crowds. So going into this tournament, they're probably best equipped to really showcase the women's game.
And they don't have to have a job on the side. They can do it full-time.
Lucky them.
What was your? Did you have a job on the side?
I had a few. I've worked in bakeries. I've worked in supermarkets, coffee shops. I was a coach. But yeah, I mean, the game is where it should be. You know, women before me, you know, obviously what I serve the game and, yeah, you know, to try and get the game in a position it's in, you know, today. And there's still so much more to be done, but they're in a fantastic position and they deserve to be full-time professionals and, you know, just be able to play the game where their sole focus is, you know, being the best they can be as athletes.
Let me play you and Gabby something we can hear from one of those playing in the championships this time. 22-year-old midfielder Ella Toon, who plays for Manchester United, is capped for the 15th time, spoke to Rob Bonnett, sports presenter for my colleagues on the Today programme. She shared the joys of scoring for England, something she's done 11 times for the senior squad already.
It's an unbelievable feeling, probably the best feeling, and however many times you do it, it won't get any different. It's still, wow, I've just scored for England. And then you hear the crowd and then the girls running at you and you're celebrating. It's probably what I did in the garden when I was 5 or 6, pretending I'm scoring for England and celebrating. So, yeah, those moments are very special and they'll stick with me for a long time. But there's that feeling as well of just putting the shirt on and stepping out onto the pitch in the first place. It's something that will never get old and something that you always just want to keep happening. And I remember my first England camp, I must have been about 14, going to the under-15s, and I thought, wow, like all I ever want to do now is play for the seniors. And yeah, obviously went through all the age groups, never missed a camp, and then got called up to my first senior camp and I was just gobsmacked. Like, I remember Phil ringing me and I was walking the dog and I was just like, oh, thank you so much. Like, you never expect it really. Like, it's something you always want and you always dream of and you work hard towards. But yeah, when you get the phone call, it's a really special moment. Obviously after this summer, you're going to see the growth of the game. We've seen it so much in previous years. And so this summer is going to be massive for women's football. So I think people will watch us in the Euros and think that they want to get involved and they want to come down and watch. And the crowds are going to be bigger next season just due to this tournament.
Farah, does that take you back, the excitement?
You know, it's funny, she mentions there about when you first get selected for the seniors and you get that call or that letter, and it's like you say thank you. You don't know how to express, you know, the feeling, the excitement of actually, you know, being selected for the first time for England. So, yeah, you say thank you and you're like, I've just said thank you for being called up for my first senior squad.
Thank you very much.
But yeah, it definitely takes you back. I mean, in terms of scoring goals, I never had crowds like Ella Toon will have tonight, you know, to score in front of. And, you know, it was always difficult. You really want to like celebrate with so much emotion, but yes. you never really, you know, when we played, was able to do that with the fans. They've got 75,000 tonight to do it in front of at Old Trafford.
Amazing.
And I'm super excited for them.
Gabby, you and the way this has changed and your role in all of this, I mean, it will be very special this evening, won't it?
It will. There will be goosebumps. We've got Alex Scott in the studio as well, who, of course, has been on a very similar journey to Farah in terms of the game and seeing the progression of professionalism. And Jonas Eidevall actually is with us, who's the Arsenal manager, the current Arsenal manager. And I think, you know, I first presented a women's football match when I came to the BBC in 2007. And what I've seen, and the commitment, actually, I have to say, you know, people like the late Lance Hardy, who was the editor of Women's Football, and he really pushed for those matches to go on the BBC, to go into homes when people weren't receiving women's football in quite the same positive way. And at the time, we were mainly showing international matches rather than the league. And now we show the WSL as well.
Yes.
And it's been such an incredible journey. I think 2012 was a bit of a landmark as well, that Great Britain team playing in a packed out Wembley against Brazil. And there will be girls in this squad, women in this squad tonight, who were 12, 13 years old then. And they would have watched those games and seen that as a normal thing, to play in front of a full Wembley. Those women now play in front of 50,000 at Wembley in the FA Cup finals. So they don't have that kind of same baggage, if you like, as Farah and her contemporaries did, playing in men's shorts, you know, being given second-class equipment. They've risen through the profession with great equipment, with the right kind of training. And, you know, they will look back and owe it to people like Farah and Alex, who trod that path. But quite rightly, they've, you know, now not got the kind of, we're not really supposed to be here attitude.
Yes.
Or we're just here because we're
baggage free, but nervous. Nervous because they want to do well. We're going to have to leave it there, Gabby. I am looking forward to your presenting tonight, to your commentary, Farah. Thank you so much. What a delight to be able to warm up with you for it this evening. And I should say, at 8 o'clock this evening, BBC One, England versus Australia. Back with you tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, and I heartily recommend you listen to the BBC's history podcast, You're Dead to Me, because, well, one, you can join me in learning all about Frederick the Great of Prussia. Two, it takes you on a historical grand tour from naughty nuns who became stitching sisters to a globe-trotting Maghrebi. And three, well, it's fun. And don't we all need a little bit of that at the moment? You can find it on BBC Sounds, don't you know? So subscribe to You're Dead to Me and have yourself a giggle as you learn. You've earned it.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the hosts of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following, to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.